Hey, y'all. The following is an episode we performed live at Michigan State University's Residential College of Arts and Humanities last September, just after we got done with our trip. This is going to be the last episode of our season, so strap yourselves in and enjoy. I'm Ben Thorpe.
I'm Evan Michelonis.
I'm Shira Kresh.
And I'm Philip Russell.
You are listening
to the Looncast.
You know those dreams where you're so sure it's not a dream? Where something crazy is happening and you even stop to ask yourself, am I dreaming? And whether it's a good dream or a nightmare, panic or elation, it's so real. And when you wake up, you feel like it really happened.
And sometimes, even after you've woken up, had your morning coffee, and moved on with your day, pieces of that dream still stick with you.
Even though you know it wasn't real.
Exactly. Like if you dreamed your girlfriend cheated on you or something, maybe you wake up a little pissed off.
Like on the wrong side of the bed?
Right, Evan.
But it was just a dream, right?
Yeah, but even dreams, despite them just being figments of our subconscious, can cause us to feel things, like real things.
So what we're saying is that even things that feel abstract, like a dream, can lead to things that are concrete and have real effects.
Right, and abstract experiences become important when they inspire and cause real things to happen. And so tonight, we're going to introduce you to a few stories in which the lines between fact and fiction become a little blurred, where the truth is as much at question as it is relevant.
These are stories that take place at the intersection of what is actual and what is abstract.
In a place none other than the Twilight Zone.
Sure.
So the first story we have for you tonight is one that we came across in Oakland, California, where we met three eccentric older women.
One of whom we stayed with, Kathy, a quirky and opinionated lady who ended up introducing us to her two best friends, a long silver-haired didgeridoo master, and her partner, a poet and professor with a heavy New York accent.
These three share many interests, from dancing, poetry, Himalayan cuisine, but most importantly, their dogs.
A one-eyed Samoyed, which is a big, fluffy, white, polar bear-looking dog named Lexi.
And Vita, a small brown mutt.
And as three women who never had children of their own, these dogs hold a really special place in their hearts. I think it's fair to say that it goes beyond the normal scope of loving a pet.
Of all the pet owners we stayed with over the course of our road trip...
And we stayed with a lot.
Did any of them love their dogs more than these women?
No way.
These ladies were crazy for their dogs.
Which became apparent when they literally came everywhere with us.
Like, to dinner.
Or for a walk in the cemetery.
To the farmer's market.
In the car.
Etc.
Kathy was our hostess.
With the mostess.
You know, the one with the one-eyed polar bear dog.
And she'd recently lost her other dog, Cosi. And that dog meant a whole lot to her, too.
So this one is my creature, and that one is my creature by default.
Oh.
She just... hangs out with you during the day because her people work a lot.
Oh, okay. Okay, so she hangs around.
And she had a housemate. Uh-oh, she's casting her spell on you already. She has a magic thing that she does.
She does?
Yes. She does it mostly with boys.
Huh.
I don't know why.
Huh.
She casts a spell. So she used to have a housemate, and she went on to the Rainbow Bridge, and she used to have a sister housemate. And she passed on to the Rainbow Bridge, and so now they hang out together.
Kathy's home was full of memorabilia, photos of them together, calendars devoted to photography of their breed, books, you name it.
Yeah, and among the other things that Kathy has in common with her friends are mantles lined with dusty pictures of their deceased four-legged loved ones.
And a backyard filled with dead pets.
So, that's the most recent Kathy's dog, Cosi, whom you've heard about. Dusty, who was like 16, boy, he was a dog much like her, and our beloved cat, Bugs. And all those animals are in our backyard.
For people who love their dogs this much, you can imagine how hard it can be to deal with the grief of losing their pets. It's like losing a kid.
But these women have found a way to continue their relationships with their animals into the afterlife, with the help of an animal communicator named Carla.
Sure. I'm Carla Simmons, and I'm an animal communicator. And that means that I do talk to people's animals, and I'm like a go-between. People have questions, I put it to their animals. The animals let me know through pictures, sometimes their feelings, sometimes their sounds, words involved. And then I get back to the people with what the animal has told me, and we go back and forth that way. And it's telepathic. It's mind-to-mind communication.
Okay, so when they first told us they could set up a call with Carla, their animal communicator, you know, at first we kind of raised our eyebrows, but we were so interested.
They told us they use Carla if there's something wrong with the animal, but they also like to check in every few months just to see how things are going. And they always use her when
an animal is dying.
You know, that's just a really big part of our grieving process, is having Carla talk to the animal when it's dying. And we found out a lot about, allegedly, right, how dogs, cats, whatever, deal with their death or their kind of policy or their kind of global feeling about not being in this world.
So what makes this story truly interesting isn't that we had the opportunity to speak with a dog psychic.
But is the conflicting and sort of confusing feelings these women had going into the whole thing.
And the interesting thing about this, the interesting thing to me, as I said before, Carla will tell us things that she couldn't possibly know from, you know, doing however animal communication works, which is what she's called. She's an animal communicator. She couldn't possibly know these things, and she'll tell us, you know. We have 3 minutes to call her. Mm-hmm. I've tried to kind of trip her up, you know, like I really, you know, I'm skeptical. Come on, this is a California thing to do, right?
Okay, so she's skeptical, right? And we are skeptical too. How could you not be? Especially when you hear something like this.
Telepathy, any of the intuitive skills are all energetic. So essentially, I'm tuning in to the energy. Well, let me back up. All of us creatures that are sentient have an energetic imprint. And that's what I tune into. It's completely individual for every single animal, plant, person. And that's what I tune into. And I can go into it a little more metaphysically. There's something called, as I understand it, the cosmic grid, which is multidimensional. But where the lines in the cosmic grid cross, there's a point of light. And that contains the energy of each individual consciousness.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So imagine you're one of us, huddled around an iPhone in the living room of this California hippy-dippy home.
These old women are sitting quietly, deep in thought, and Vita, the dog, who looks completely unfazed by everything that's going on around her, is curled up next to us, sleeping on the couch. And this woman on the other end is rattling off some crazy theory about consciousness and grids and energy.
And she goes on to say that her work is actually enhanced by doing it over the phone. She has clients all over the world, but she made sure to point out that...
So it's just more cost-effective to do it over the phone.
That is convenient.
Okay, I know it sounds crazy, right? Like, no wonder our friends were telling us that she's skeptical. But no matter how inclined or disinclined you are to believe things of this nature, that's not really what this is about. Because if you are skeptical, like me, it really is easy to scoff at these things.
So we're not asking you to change your minds about the metaphysical and how the universe works. Instead, we're asking you to look at what objectively is happening as a result of their beliefs.
So after asking a few questions, we jumped into the main act.
Seeing Carla's psychic abilities put to work.
And so it went like this. They would ask a question to Carla, questions like, how's old Sweet Pea doing up there? Or is Buggy still visiting the garden?
And after long, awkward pauses, Carla would return and say something like, yes, old Sweet Pea is doing very well, frolicking through heaven, actually, and Buggy is doing just fine. He visits often.
Finally, it was Kathy's turn, and she took the opportunity to check in with the dog she lost not too long ago.
And Kathy, do you have anything in particular you'd like to ask, Cosi?
I don't know if I have to ask her anything. I just want her to know I love her and tell her thank you.
Oh, sure.
And Lexi misses her desperately, so if I don't know how to make that be a question.
Sorry, what was the last part?
Lexi misses her companion dog.
Yeah.
But I'm sure Kosi was an older soul, too, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's really the sense I get.
Yeah.
She's very confident about what she does. I mean, it's all matter of fact and back and forth. And very, she coaches Vita really well.
Oh, thank you. That's great.
Yeah, yeah. But let me tell her how much you love her. Hold on, please.
At this point, I imagined her on the other line reading through notes.
No, Shira. She was tuning in.
Well, whatever she was doing, it was silent.
And awkward. For what felt like a long time.
I hope Kosi is helping Andy.
Oh, she just loves hearing that, Kathy. And of course, the other thing I wanted to say about Kosi is that she's really bright, and she is losing her dog form. That she, after a while, beings get used to showing how they actually are, rather than showing me a form, which the form helps me recognize her, for example, showing up as a Samoyed, but she's starting to get more egg-shaped, and where she's just this form, and she's very beautiful.
Is she becoming a star? Is she becoming a star?
Well, it's more like a luminous egg.
Cool. Thank you, Carla.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool.
Right around this time, we started to hear some sniffles.
At first, I thought they were laughing.
But it turned out that Carla's making contact was really getting to them.
And it's crazy, right? It really looked like these women buy it. Like, they take this whole experience seriously. But I kind of get it.
What?
Well, in a way, it's helping them relive these experiences. It's a way to bring their dogs back, however briefly. Because even though they went into it with a level of skepticism, it was real in the moment. Not long after the call, one of the women told us this story.
But the day that Sweet Pea died, this is an amazing story. We were in Lake Tahoe, and this is, if you love to go in the snow, this is one of the places. It was probably the year after Kate had come like twice in a row. And there was something wrong with Sweet Pea. We had taken her up on Christmas, and she had sort of collapsed, and we came back to this altitude. She bounced back, took her back up to the snow. There had been a big snowstorm, and it had been a horrible snow. It had been a horrible snowstorm, and it was a year that there hadn't been a whole lot of snow. But she wouldn't go out. She was falling around the snow. We went out with other people. We came back, and she collapsed again. We took her to the vet. The vet said she has a terrible mass in the middle of her body. She's going to die. So, okay, she's going to die. She's going to die here. She's going to die in the snow in Tahoe that she loves. And we all went out and howled. But before that, she came out, and all of us were sitting around, like 8 or 10 people, and go see Lexi. Yeah. Everybody, she was like, she was a dog that would not, see Venus here? Sweet Pea might be out there. She's not a very, very social dog. She doesn't really care about people. But she did that day. She stayed in the room with everybody.
She came and said goodbye to everybody.
And then she went and died. And we howled. So she taught us how to die.
She still thinks it's creepy.
But she was amazing.
So, do you think that's real? Like, that really happened?
No way. They got scammed.
But, I mean, did they, though? They kind of knew, didn't they? They knew it wasn't real. They told us it wasn't real.
Yeah, but tears, Ben. Uncomfortable, real-life, salty tears.
And I kind of think that's the point. The story wasn't real, but it helped them get resolution for something that was. It gave them a kind of catharsis. It doesn't matter if they really talk to their dead dog, because it's helping them to heal and recover in very real ways. It's real in an emotional way.
Still sounds like some bullshit to me. If our stories aren't real, then what's the point of them?
But it is real, just in a different way.
Yeah, in a bullshit way.
From an evolutionary perspective, the answer you might think, well, actually, no. Evolution doesn't necessarily kind of give you beliefs or give you ways to create beliefs that are that accurately reflect what the world looks like. Mm-hmm. It gives you a way to create beliefs that make you a successful organism in the world.
What the hell? Who was that? That was Jeff Stevens, an evolutionary psychologist at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln.
Oh, yeah. We've had him on a couple of episodes.
Yeah, because I think he does a great job of explaining why we tell stories and why it doesn't always matter how true those stories are.
Okay, I'll bite. Why doesn't it matter?
Well, Jeff explains it like this.
Imagine you hear a rustle in the bushes. There's two possible states of the world. One is there's a dangerous animal in the bushes, right? And the other one is there's not a dangerous animal in the bush.
Okay, so there are two possibilities. Either there's a tiger or it's just the wind rustling in the grass.
Exactly. It could be a monstrous predator or just some grass. But you have to decide which one it is. And it matters which one you choose.
If the state of the world is there's a dangerous predator behind those bushes and your response is to approach, right? That's an error, right?
Not going to answer well.
Yeah, yeah. So you have a false belief about the state of the world. You thought things were safe. They were not, okay? And that's an error.
So over time, we become really good at guessing which one it is, right? Grass or tiger?
Not really. We actually just overguess how many tigers there are because that keeps us safer. We don't want to be right. We want to be alive. So accuracy, truth, that counts for less than survival.
We've been tailored to minimize these costs rather than trying to just get a real, true representation of what the world is like.
I think I see where you're going with this.
Well, yeah. So think about it like a story. The story that makes the most sense is the story that helps you get through the day, not the story that is the most true. You need a story that helps you make it. And stories have always been doing this for us, not giving us accuracy, but helping us to survive.
So are you saying it doesn't matter if it's true or not?
No. I'm saying that sometimes truth isn't the right way to judge a story. Sometimes it's more a question of, what do I get out of this story? How does it help me?
Huh. Yeah, I have no idea what that means.
Okay, that's okay. Because I think the next story will clear it up just a little bit. It's about a guy who falls in love with someone he meets while on a DMT trip.
That clears literally nothing up.
Just wait.
Hello, my name is Dylan Meeks.
Hi, Dylan.
I get uncomfortable talking about it because the more I talk about it, the more nuts I feel I sound.
Yeah, no kidding.
Will you stick with me on this?
Okay.
Just a warning, though, this story does involve drugs.
I was smoking DMT and, like, a lot of it for a few years.
DMT? Dimethyltryptamine. It's a psychedelic compound that puts you into a kind of dreamlike trance. It's a short-lived high, but it's said to be very, very intense.
And the thing that started Dylan's DMT habit was his experiences with depression.
I was really resistant towards medication, and I was on medication for a while, and it kind of shed the light on the problem. It was like, okay, I could feel this way, but I also just kind of feel shitty. I feel like it was really necessary because that was kind of like the starting point of like, shit's wrong, I need to change something.
After taking prescribed pharmaceutical medication and not liking the way that it left him feeling, he started to take DMT. One story in particular stood out to us about Dylan's trips. It goes like this.
So we smoked, we settled in, we took our hits and just watched the leaves fade away. When everything that I could see sort of faded, I closed my eyes, and there was a wonderful display of patterns going on, and that pattern kind of did its little dance and shifted and opened up into this black, like, really wide open black space, just filled with people. There was a floor, they were, like, milling about. It was like a party. It was really weird. It was the first time that I had experienced machine elves that were like, they had like distinct features about them. So I get there and there's this party and I see across the way there's a girl talking to someone, like a female elf talking to another person. And she has like a tall skinny guy and like a shorter fat guy. But we talked and she was like, "You're here finally." And I was like, "Oh, we know each other." And she's like, yeah, it's okay that you don't remember. Come on, let's just go. And I was like, well, I'll just believe you. Come on. It was just like the feeling of romance was just like, I was having that reaction. I don't remember exactly like what we did. I remember hanging out with her two friends, and it's like we were all being reunited, and we were just having a time at this party. And I remember dancing with her, and like as things were fading, like everything else, as I was coming out of the trip, everything else around her was fading, and it was just her, and she like was like, bye, and I was like, bye, and it was like kind of, I just kind of came out of it, and I was like, like a little part like heartbroken and a little part like the happiest I had ever felt before.
Wait, back it up. He fell in love with a figment of his drug-induced imagination.
Well,
that's the story you just said.
Okay, yeah.
How can that be helpful? Wouldn't falling in love with a product of a drug-induced state just lead you further down the rabbit hole toward dependency and therefore only contribute to the issues at hand?
Well, I guess it could, but I think Dylan knew it wasn't real in that way, that this woman wasn't someone he could call up and find again. Because as real as those experiences felt while he was tripping, like falling in love, he knew they weren't real. But they gave him a vision of what could be real. In a way, that experience became a guide for him, a way to move forward.
You take psychedelics, and you can see what it means to be enlightened and to realize thoughts and to realize actions and to realize yourself. But once you're not on psychedelics, you can't remember like exactly how it was. You just remember that there were things that you were overcoming. So it sheds a light on the bindings, but I feel like you have to take a different path to actually unlock them.
Okay, I think I get what's being said here. It's a lot like the debate around depression. Some say you need to just work through these things practically on your own. And then there are others that say, no, you have to take drugs to right a chemical imbalance.
Right. There are those that believe it's important that you work through your emotions by building habits, changing how you live day to day in that way, which will then change how you're feeling. But there are people on the other side that say that pharmaceutical drugs are important to help you get to a place of health and stability immediately, to help you get through the day.
And what I think Dylan's saying is that there's a little bit of both, that taking drugs, whether psychedelic or pharmaceutical, helps show you how you could be healthy, but you have to make practical changes in your life and the physical world in order to make that vision real.
So in a way, it's like meeting this girl and feeling loved, that feeling of being cared for. That helped him find a way to do that in the real world, to love himself in a more practical way.
Huh. So is that how he felt about the experience?
Yeah. We actually asked him that exact question.
So I guess this would be another one where I wonder if did that feeling of romance and something good and something positive and something, you know, kind of beautiful, like friendship and relationship, did that moment of meeting her coincide with you starting to feel like you were coming back to yourself and feeling, you know, better and feeling healthier and feeling...
It did. If I'm going to take the more rational, like, broad strokes, like, this represents something sort of thing...
Sorry.
No. That's the good thing. That's, like, that's what you have to do or else you go completely nuts. It's part of reintegrating the experience. I finally met the potential to fully love or to accept love or just, you know, something like that.
Or to love yourself.
Yeah.
So is this what we're saying? That these experiences, these stories that we tell, whether real or not, if they help motivate us to change, then that's enough. Because it brings some of that experience back with us. It makes it real, even if it's not necessarily real.
Right. It became real in its own way. Because in a way, looking back, it really is as though he met this person. She helped him through something because he changed himself to match that reality. And it's kind of like it really happened.
When you're there, it's 100% true and everything. But then you come back and it's completely, there's such a difference in what you're experiencing that you're like, yeah, that was true then, but this is now, and it's not the same. It's like, it could just be completely false, because in that mindset it makes perfect sense, but here, like, it doesn't mean anything, and it doesn't make
as much sense.
Yeah, it's not.
So it's real in the moment, but it's something that you question afterwards.
I guess so.
Yeah.
Yeah. But even in memory, it's real.
So our next story is a little different. With Dylan, he had a wild experience that he couldn't really make sense of from a logical standpoint, but it helped him find a part of himself that had been lost for a long time.
This story is about having an experience that you thought would be good for you, but ends up going in the complete opposite direction.
And it all centers around two friends attending a live exorcism, and one of the two being a little more affected by it than the other.
Max Howard, a fan of Valooncast, working at Beginning of the End, and I have a story about a touring exorcist.
So you're probably wondering, how did this all start?
I guess, like, how it started was, I was like, I would love to go to someone who just flat out believes us and see what they're like. So I probably found the worst person I could talk to, this guy named Jay Bartlett. He's affiliated with this whole slew of, like, exorcism churches, and he goes around the country exorcising people.
Max found out that Jay was going to be doing a live exorcism that was happening in a Holiday Inn in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
So naturally, he asked all of his friends to come, but as you can imagine, most of them said no.
All of them except one. We're not going to use her real name, so how about we call her Hannah?
So we both go. First mistake, we're both dressed in complete black. And then it's also very strange because when we walked in, we thought it was going to be in this huge conference room, and it turns out to be in this smaller conference room that's right by the pool, and there's no windows, and there's about probably 12 people in the room. So I go in, and Jay Bartlett, the touring exorcist, addresses me, and he says, "So, why were you interested in coming? What brought you here?" And, you know, I was just trying to be casual. I was like, I'm just a very curious person, and this is something I've never experienced before. Just wanted to see what this was about, you know? Because, I mean, when am I going to see this again? It's like, okay. Kind of files that back for later.
Max went on to tell us about how this initial interaction with Jay really set the tone for the entire experience.
So it'd be like, "Hey, Phil. So, what's your favorite color?"
Red?
Huh. Interesting. Okay. Yeah, so kind of like that. Jay would ask the attendants simple questions in a very nonchalant way.
As if he was just having small talk with them before the show.
Small talk that exposed certain subtleties that could perhaps be tapped into later on. Then Jay introduces himself to the crowd, and he's just saying all of this crazy stuff.
For example, he was claiming that he was from a family of Freemasons and Illuminati, but he had escaped and forged his own path. If you think that's weird, though, just keep on listening to what happened next.
This is where things, like, it's already pretty weird, but this is where it started getting uncomfortable. There's this woman behind me, and she's this whiteboard, right? And she's writing down all these notes on this whiteboard, and she'll raise it up for Jay to see. And Jay will look at it, and then he'll kind of nod, and she'll put it down.
And those notes that the woman was writing on her whiteboard were like power plays.
So, for example, knowing that Phil likes red could be twisted against him.
Yeah, it's unclear, but it seemed like Whiteboard Lady and Jay had a system in place to gather information, which they would use later against people in the audience.
And at one point, this woman was fixated on Max, singling him out almost. She just kept looking at him, and they actually have, like, a stare-off.
The staring contest to end them all.
But she wouldn't acknowledge him, even after he tried waving her down.
And it's here that Jay stops to single Max out as a demonic spy.
What?
Yep. Whether it's because he didn't like Max's curiosity, or maybe just having someone in the room that he couldn't control, he called out Max as a demonic spy, someone controlled by the spirit of doubt and homosexuality.
What?
Yeah, he really pulled out all the crazy tricks in the book.
But what I really think this is about is getting everyone to doubt the people around them, to be a little less certain of the person they are sitting next to, because that fear gave Jay more power.
And once he divided people, he started zeroing in on a couple of the audience members.
After this lady's raising this whiteboard and, you know, saying all this, writing what I can only assume is crazy stuff up there, Jay stops and he says, okay, so the next thing we're going to do is, like, we're going to pray over your family lineage, and we're going to try to pray away these, like, evil family, you know, curses.
So he starts off by picking Max's friend, Hannah, out of a group of people.
It just gets weirder and weirder as it goes. Then he started saying this stuff about her that was... you know when, like, you'll get your, like, fortune told, and it's just, like, right on the edge of something that's almost true, and it seems a little too, like, you know, too pointed to be just, like, kind of random? He kind of said some stuff about her, and she, you know, had this... she didn't say it at the time, but she had some, like, family history with, like, depression and suicide. It kind of, like... pointedly said that to her, and she was like, that's, you know, really weird that you would say that, because that is something that is, like, really on my mind a lot, you know?
He starts saying these things to her that end up being kind of true, and it started to really affect her.
Yeah, the weird part about it is that Max said Hannah never told Jay anything about that family history prior to this point. It must have just been a wild guess, one that paid off for Jay.
This Jay guy seems to be really good at exploiting parts of people that he knows will strike a nerve. It seems to be a combination of knowing which questions to ask, paying really close attention to details, subtleties, and lucky guesses. I guess it's kind of a skill.
Max made it pretty clear that Jay's whole gig revolved around him fishing information out of people as potential ammunition to be used against them later.
Remember how I asked Phil what his favorite color was? Well, fun fact about the color red... it was someone else's favorite color, too. Care to guess, Phil?
Oh, God. Who?
Not God. Satan, Philip!
It's an example of him using information against people in order to construct a story that works with his beliefs and controls theirs in the process.
So what happens after he gets into her head?
My friend starts just bawling. Like, just crying her eyes out. I'm like, do you want to go? This is too much. Maybe we should leave. And before she can really say anything, this Jay guy comes in and he starts talking to her, and he starts telling this 6-year-old to come up, and she's responding, not in like as in like a childlike voice, but it's just very, very scary, because I didn't know what he was doing at all. And I didn't think it was something spiritual, but I was like, you are really messing with my friend, and something is going on with her. And then she starts coming out of it, and she starts talking about why she was crying. It was because she was thinking about her mom's side of the family. She had this aunt who had committed suicide, and that was always something that had really weighed on her, and it felt like she's always scared that that was something that was, like, biological to the rest of her family and to her, even, maybe.
So imagine that you're Max. You're in this sweaty, muggy conference room in the basement of a Holiday Inn, watching this self-proclaimed exorcist completely frazzle your friend to the point that she's in tears. What do you do?
The worst part about it all is that Jay targeted a bunch of people in the room throughout the entire ordeal in a similar manner.
And this thing lasted for over 5 hours.
5 hours of literal
and metaphorical
hell.
And it all culminated in an hour-long exorcism of one of Jay's devout believers. We don't have time to get into that part of the story, but let me tell you, it's a trip.
And not a good one. So we asked Max what happened after it was all over. How did he feel? What do you make of the whole outburst from Hannah? How did she feel after it?
I think now if I would ask her, she would say it wasn't helpful. By the time she said it was pretty cathartic, and like it actually got some things out. I don't think that'd be the answer now. But, that was a weird thing. She did say it was very cathartic. And when I was there, it was so real.
Yeah.
and maybe if I looked, like, to the point where, like, I still won't, like, disregard it completely as being, like, a genuine, like, spiritual experience. Even though everything around it points to it not being, you know? Like, it doesn't seem like a spiritual environment. This guy is obviously a crazy person. But, you know, just being there, it was just... It was powerful. It was really powerful. If anyone in that room was possessed, I would think it would be Jay. Because he seems like the most malicious out of anyone. And I don't think what he was doing was good.
So what do we make of all this? Of demons and exorcisms and people being really moved by this creeper?
I guess for me it's this, that our stories have a lot of power, that they make things real to us that otherwise wouldn't be.
And that can be a good thing, like with DMT Guy or to some extent the Dog Whisperer. It can help us come to terms with a loss or imagine a better life for ourselves.
But it can be a bad thing too. It can be used as a way to control people, to scare and separate them.
So what's important here might be twofold. That stories have a different value to them than facts. And sometimes we have to suspend our disbelief a little to understand what matters to people about a story. We can't judge them based on facts alone.
But when we do that, we still have to be critical. We still have to ask, is this a good story? A story that's helping me or helping other people?
Or does it harm them? Is it a story that hurts us?
Because with stories, maybe the best judge of their value isn't necessarily how true they are.
But how we behave because of them. And I think that's the takeaway from this whole show.
That stories have power.
They have the power to reveal and create truth.
A truth that isn't immediately apparent.
But we have to be careful.
Because sometimes those stories give us the power to become happier, help us to make sense of loss, or just to make it through a day.
But other times, they can give us too much power. A power over others.
So we have to be cautious about what kinds of stories we tell. And especially, which ones we allow to come back from the Twilight Zone.
Cast is produced and hosted by Ben Thorpe, Philip Russell, Evan Michelonis, and myself, Shira Krush. Special thanks to the Residential College and the Arts and Humanities at MSU for having us last fall to perform this show live. Thanks also to the wonderful humans who lent their voices to this episode. Kathy, Nan, Toby, Carla, Jeff Stevens, Dylan Meeks, and Max Howard. Music for this episode was performed by our very own Evan Michelonis. And with that, we're closing the book on season one of the Looncast. Okay, I lied. We have one more After Hours for you, so stay tuned for that. But since we will be taking a break for a little while, make sure to follow us on our social media accounts for the latest, bonus, between-the-season content, updates, merch, and more. We're on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and you can also check out our website at thelooncast.org. Oh yeah, one last thing. If you enjoyed this show, or anything we've done, ever, please leave us a rating and an honest review on iTunes. Not only do we love to hear your feedback, your reviews give us exposure so that other people can find our show. That's all for now. Thanks for listening.
Can we all do like a sign off? Bye. Bye for a season. I'm Ben Thorpe.
For a season, you will be missed.
Peace.
Evan Michelonis signing off.
I hope you come back from the dead.
Stay classy.